define brief community as the process through which in a classroom, an academic classroom on race, students draw from academic grounding to build a kind of intellectual courage about the questions that they ask and the kind of answers that they're able to hear and the kind of, you know, the distance that they travel intellectually. So they build this intellectual courage, and at the same time they are able to exhibit more interpersonal empathy. So the courage is the bravery part, and this empathy is the community part. And it's very exciting for people to think that this applies across the board. It kind of has resonance for learning generally. But I'm really talking about learning about race, and I'm really talking about academic grounding when you're engaging with race. And quickly, by grounding, I mean combination of having actual content that you're looking at, so texts, broadly construed, but also what the discussion is producing in terms of, you know, knowledge, old and new. So what you're reading, but also what you're coming up with your peers and your professor, so that's content. And then academic culture, which is like the ways of being that the teacher or the professor has set forth as ideal for learning. So really the stress is that this is an academic setting and that this is a group of people oriented towards learning. So when people wanna extrapolate it, I'm a little bit hesitant because I feel very strongly that both having content that the group is attending to and being oriented to learning, sort of having the identity of a learner be the primary kind of driver, is important.
Hello and welcome to another episode of This Anthro Life. As always, I'm Ryan Collins.
And I'm Adam Gamwell.
And today we're kicking off the second episode of our Diversity and Inclusion series partnered with Brandeis University. With this series, we're really looking to have conversations dealing with diversity in higher education and beyond. So today we have Dr. Janine DeNovias joining us in, and Ab can fill us in a little bit more on that.
Sure, yeah, we had a great conversation with her, and so she is teaching at the Graduate School of Education at Harvard University in Cambridge, Mass. So we sat down with Dr. DeNovias to discuss her work in Brave Community. We mentioned this in our first episode of the Diversity series, and so this is a really wonderful continuation where we actually get to sit down with the author and the architect of some ideas we've mentioned in previous conversations. So this was a great talk where we thought about what does it mean to teach race as content in the classroom, and what space does higher education have to be a place where diversity and inclusion can be an intentional and focal point of conversation.
Right. And just reflecting on those conversations with Janine, it was so fun and so inspiring in so many ways. So we hope that you feel the same.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we love the conversation. We think you'll love it too. And again, as always, you know, tweet at us. Let us know what your favorite takeaways of the episode were after you get through it. You know, we get these great conversations into Janine's story, into what it means to teach, and what it means really just to take seriously the conversations, to hold ourselves accountable as educators, as people in classrooms.
Exactly, and to really think about strategies for engaging students in the classroom, because we know that these conversations can be very hard, and yet they're so meaningful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so they gotta be had. So anyway, we hope you enjoyed. This is a great conversation. We loved it. We think you will too. And yeah, enjoy.
My origin story sounds awesome.
It does.
It's like I'm a superhero.
You are.
I'm a race girl. No. I joke because there was a lot of, this is actually connected to the origin story. So there was a lot of trepidation when I was a doctoral student, mm-hmm, about not becoming race girl. And what that had to do with was a couple of things. And one of it was the kind of like naive apprehension about kind of performing some kind of cliche of like identity and your interests, you know?
Yeah.
And so I came to grad school with the intention, I think you mentioned last time, to talk about something that was a little bit more broad than race in schools, which was the kind of predicament I was in my professional life. So I was at Columbia University. I graduated from there, and then I worked there at their core curriculum office. And so they have this like epic great books curriculum that has been there and has been a source of controversy and education for many generations of Colombians, right? It's sort of like a rite of passage to both take the corps and if you're so inclined, protest the corps and try to abolish the corps. Yeah, and it's a series of European literature, philosophy, political theory texts and music and art. And it's presented, it's the Western canon, though it doesn't understand itself that way. It understands itself, I would say, as like foundational texts that people with a liberal education in the U.S. need. Mm. And so while I was working there in the office, there was a kind, there's always a cyclical attempt to think about the questions of inclusion with that curriculum. Students tend to be quite eager to get that done. Why are we learning? Dead white males, the faculty are invested in having a kind of coherent, rigorous process of thinking through these questions. And so I was involved in my own like brief time with some of this work. And I came here with the intention of exploring that, like what would that look like if you were to still have this kind of required, what everybody needs to know kind of curriculum, but you moved away from a kind of genealogy of thought that stays in the European canon, self-perceived as the West, and actually does things that have to do with what all was going on with the West from the other traditions. So, but that would require me to commute. And so I came here with a kid who was like a fifth grader and is now in high school. And so I couldn't really work on the Columbia thing. And then I started to take classes in education. And race was kind of there. And in education, the first thing, the hook, was that it was omnipresent. I found the field to be sort of saturated with race, but not a kind of critical interrogation of it. And then when I looked at higher education, it was a similar experience where you guys went through a really great, actually, I feel like you did the literature review for all the things last time, so I don't have to cover it. But, you know, that whole thing about the diversity rationale and the and the Supreme Court decisions sort of borders where the research has been. So the research came out of this need to prove, which is parenthetically really depressing that we need to prove this, but it's good for people to be in diverse college classrooms with diverse people doing diverse curricula, right? So from California versus Bakke all the way to Fisher, the Supreme Court decisions, you've had social science sort of marshal this evidence all kinds of ways, any way you can cut it. And so I looked at that body of research. I was like, well, this is cool. We have this consensus, but we don't spend a lot of time in classrooms insofar as, you know, if this is good for folks, what's good? And there was a lot of work on what doesn't work. So Sue's work on microaggressions, Steele's work on stereotype threat and all that stuff. And there was a lot of work on outcomes that said it was good. But I was really kind of personally interested in when learners are learning about race and it is compelling to them, it's challenging, but it's productive. What's happening? You know, and that's kind of where the study came out of. That was my question. It's kind of like, I'm going to check to see if there's something about a classroom that makes it particularly productive for this thing that we seem to really not be good at anywhere else, which is like learn about race. So that's what the drive of the study was about. And before I talk about the study, just to close out the origin story, when I settled into like this is what I'm going to study, it made sense to me because I'm Cape Verdean. I was born in Cape Verde, which was a Portuguese colony until 75. And I was born in 76. And so I was raised in a kind of post-revolutionary household. And certainly in my generation, it was very integral to our understanding that emancipatory racial project was an intellectual project. It, you know, it really was as much about fighting a war as it was about a kind of redress of ideas about who Africans were and a reintroduction of another perspective. So the kind of question of like learning about race to sort of unlearn racism is sort of integral to my intellectual life. And so when I found myself, as you know, you're in grad school, you find yourself doing something that actually has all this resonance with who you are, actually. And you're like, oh, okay, so this ends up being my question. That's okay. Makes sense.
Makes sense, right?
It makes sense, yeah. And then so I was born there. Race was important there. I moved to the States when I was 15, and I went to high school in Brockton, Massachusetts. Went to a public high school, and it was important to understand like American race as a particular way that was very different. It's always been incredibly powerful as an explanatory thing and incredibly obfuscating as a concept. And I thought, well, let's look into this.
Is there, like, I think that's an awesome origin story to it. Like,
yeah.
Is there, because you mentioned before too, this question of like, thinking through race and exploring it as an intellectual exercise. And then so how much of that is also, is there some sort of felt component also?
Absolutely.
In terms of like, you know, in sort of navigating this, particularly in the classroom, right?
Oh, yeah.
It's incredibly tough.
Yeah. I mean, I think that was this is what I say. So part of what I did after I did the dissertation, so the dissertation is a study, and then I started to talk like you saw me at Lesley, where, and this is a credit to that institution and other institutions, where people are asking folks like me to come and talk to faculty who really want to do this well, and they're like, you know, forget the study, like we don't want to hear, just like what do people who do this well do, you know, tell us. And I think one of the most powerful things that I try to convey to people who teach about race is that race is a concept for inquiry and a lived experience twined, that there isn't a way to sort of have the intellectual conversation that's not also a kind of emotional personal conversation. There is the cognitive and the affective is in the concept. And so, yes, that's the trigger for all kinds of things to go badly. But actually, from a learning theory perspective, that's the sweet spot. That's when people learn. So it's a matter of what I tell faculty and teachers is it's in the room anyway. It's either going to be like the special sauce or it's going to be the fuel that burns the circus down. Like, you get to decide, are you going to leverage this really particular thing? You have eager students, you have Americans, you have people who have this on their mind.
Yeah.
Or are you going to, like, dodge it?
Yeah.
And it's going to blow up in your face, most likely. You know? And even if you don't try to dodge it, it might still blow up in your face.
But it's still there either way, right?
It's still there. So I think, yeah, and I think for me personally, the way that I have to, that I think I'm comfortable with the work is to have a critical perspective because it is a lived experience. Because I think both in my training, even before graduate school, the only way to not become part of the problem sort of as a scholar of this content, as a scholar of race, is to maintain a critical stance, right? Like a deconstructive stance. Otherwise, it becomes ethically problematic for me. Like, am I just going to be saying these things and sort of reifying the monster that, you know, I think in higher ed, to the point about your series, we do struggle with that reality that we are trying to educate people for, I think, not a post-racial, but a post-racist future. However, we are not always able to do that in ways that are moving that way, that there's something about the way institutions behave that are sometimes regressive. And so I'm super sensitive about that. So my initial joke about, like, I ain't trying to be race girl is because I ain't trying to be part of the problem, you know?
Yeah.
It's a very messy terrain to work in and think in. And it's very easy to be like, you know, let me just find another topic to do.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But the work has to be done, you know, kind of.
Definitely. So, I mean, thinking about what you're saying, too, with a lot of classes where you're going to be talking or you have the opportunity to talk about race.
Right.
For thinking about anthropology courses, it's going to be pretty easy to sometimes bring that up depending on what your subject matter is. But
right.
If you're teaching, you know, like calculus, or if you're teaching some sort of
coding.
Yeah. Do you have any types of strategies that could be used in that type of setting?
I think as I'm talking to faculty different places, I'm learning actually a lot from them, and sort of my favorite thing is the Q&A. So, you know, I feel like that's when we really get work done. And I was at this institution not long ago, and someone asked me that who taught natural sciences and bio or something, and they had a tough, like, I think everyone has had a tough semester in the last 3 years, more or less, or actually five years. It's been, things have been particularly heightened. And that was his question sort of after my talk. He said, okay, this colleague, you know, he teaches FM Lit, or my sociology colleagues, they have courses where they have the content to work with. And I told him I didn't have an easy answer, because the idea that I put forth in terms of academic grounding, as you all discussed, is that you have content and then you have the culture. So you're going to teach about race as content, and then you have a set of ways of being that you need people to adopt to do this well. But if you're teaching bio and something blows up that is completely outside of your purview, what do you do? And this man answered his own question, and he said, I think what I need to do is some version of grounding my classroom before day two or week two that surfaces some of these issues and puts us kind of on the same page, even though we're not talking about race. Mm-hmm. And I was like, it sounds good. It also sounds like a lot to ask. It also sounds like a lot to assume a classroom needs. But I think we might have to just admit that we need to do these kinds of, not, I don't even think preemptive, but like intentional moves when we are dealing with diverse classrooms in 2018. Like, I think I spend a lot of time being like, is that, you know, like, is that fair? Like, does somebody teaching calculus need to be, you know, maybe you can't avoid the blow up. The blow up is the blow up. Right. But then I'm like, is it a lot to take 20 minutes and have like a real conversation with adults about the fact that this is a particular space and here's how I understand it differently, being different than like Twitter or Facebook.
Right.
And here's kind of what I think we should be doing. So actual practitioners and teachers have helped me abstract these concepts such that they're becoming more applicable even in my mind. So the setting of the stage that someone teaching slave narratives needs to do maybe feels a little bit more salient, like the topic is hard. It's actually about race. It's actually about painful things. So, yeah, I'm going to do that. But really what they're doing at the most abstract level is saying, as a community that is going to be oriented towards learning, we have to make some commitments towards each other. Mm-hmm. As your teacher, you know, not the authority figure, but the caretaker of this community, I want us to engage in a conversation about what we think we need. And, you know, in my classrooms, that's what I do. I just say, what do you all remember about learning race? Most people have very bad recall, you know. How would you rather have it happen? I put all this cool stuff on the board. Mm. And it's usually very ambitious. You know, people want safety but bravery, and they want to say crazy things but be forgiven. Like, we all have things we wish for. And then I tell the group, okay, so tell me what we need to do to get to that, this amazing, ideal thing on the board. Mm-hmm. So I call it back planning your norms. So we envision what we all need, and then you tell me how you're going to act so that we succeed, right? So we're all, now we're all connected. Like, I looked you in the eye, you looked me in the eye, you said, this is what we're going to do. So next week when something pops off, I can legitimately say, but hey, we said that we would find a way to hear people with empathy, even if they like piss us off. So I think that's what that person needs to do. I do feel that I'm empathetic to the eye roll, you know, to people like, really, I have to do this? And I think that it takes less time and is less damaging than the drama. The bad moment, you know, when you say something you didn't mean to say and it's offensive and you have absolutely no relationship with that student and you have you've set up no grounding. You have nothing to reference. You have nothing to, you don't have a relationship that can repair itself. So that's what I would say. Spend some time, you know.
No, I think that's an excellent answer. And it's, I think, something that all of us can learn from as educators, too. It reminds me of a classroom that I was in for human evolution about 10 years ago, back when I was an undergrad in the dark ages. So the instructor was really good at establishing the room should be a space for critical thought, and that this was just a space to evaluate evidence that we had. So we're going to look at what that evidence is first and then try to put it in a way that we can talk about it with each other.
Okay.
And she was quick to say, you know, this is not some place where we're going to be talking about other explanations for the origins of humans. Those are all fine and acceptable, but here it's to look at this particular set of evidence critically.
Yeah. It worked.
It worked.
I feel like I have a dream that this would be like the new like way we educate American citizens. And I always bring this up as a also when I mean citizen, because we're living in this time, I do mean like people who are here. I don't mean to exclude anyone from that category in my mind. But like people who will get to, who have to live in America, right? It's this idea that I think when I've watched students and I've taught students learn about race, what I'm after is exactly what you talked about in terms of that, like evolution, the parameters. Mm-hmm. It's sort of like this. It is not a matter of predicting or overdetermining how students are going to think politically about the issue. It's a matter of setting up some kind of parameters for what is the rigorous, you know, socio-historical correct way to think about this thing. Because it is not actually a matter of opinion that slavery happened. It's not a matter of opinion that race determines people's lived outcomes on every measure. It's not for discussion. This is not like a, it's not a blue state or a red state issue. And I feel like we've never tried to live in a, to create a world where educated people have a kind of obligation to hold those kinds of accurate views above other things. Meaning, you might be a climate denialist, right? But we don't entertain that in the biology department.
Yeah.
You can have that opinion, but we just don't entertain that. And I feel like what I try to impart on people is that it's not correct. It's ethically inappropriate. It's morally reprehensible that when you're teaching about race, you pretend that it is so fluid that it doesn't have a core that is the same as climate. Like, no, there's evidence, there's data, things happen, we know what those things are. I think we could try, you know, and we don't try in elementary. We don't try in high school. And so I'm after higher ed taking responsibility for that insofar as it can, because we're in trouble, because we really, you know, we everywhere you can see the result of having a society that is actually cultivating a kind of ignorance about this, as opposed to not only are we not like getting smarter, but we literally are being incited to be ignorant about it. Be like, I don't know. I don't know what happened. Yeah. You know, I don't know if people
were.
I wasn't there. It's historical, you know. You know, slave owner to some, hero to others. All of this stuff, when things are difficult, when a nation is trying to actually grapple with difference, it's not productive. And I think maybe I'm naive, but I think young people, college age people, would appreciate, for the most part, to be told the truth. You know, I think that's why people try to learn. And so, yeah, it would be that same thing. It would be like, yes, you can look, you can have whatever perspective you have on how we fix the problem. Well, we could start to create a kind of consensus about what the problem is, where it comes from, who did what, you know, what happened when, like, those are things, you know. I tell my students all the time, like, these are written records. We're not talking about oral histories, you know.
Right, right.
Yeah.
No, that's really great to think with. And there is, you know, higher ed is in this very particular interesting place where it's like, you know, because one of the brief things we mentioned in the first episode of the series too is that, you know, Peter Thiel is one of these famous venture capitalists is saying we don't really need higher education anymore. You can get your you know, sort of vocational skills elsewhere, you know. But what you're articulating, and I hear you saying, is that this is actually one of the things that higher education can do specifically well. And this is not a straight up liberal arts education, like to be contrast against vocational education, but right. It's actually how to be treated as an adult.
Yeah.
In which we like live in a world where facts matter and that we can have certain agreed upon understandings of historical records and perspectives, and that we can sort of be held to task because we account for each other.
Right.
Right.
Right. I feel like that I have this whole thing where I'm every time a Peter Thiel type says something like that, I'm always like, man, if these dudes like would just take a class on something that would that would just allow them to not have a view that is so problematically articulated. Mm-hmm. Meaning, any responsible student of public education, of education, and a parent, like I'm both, understands some of the critiques that we all know about how learning could be more tacked on reality and the needs that people have, and we should flip the classroom and all of that work. You know, people should be learning deeply from day one. There's no reason to keep people from learning complicated concepts, all that. But to just look onto America as it is and to say, yeah, nobody needs it. It's irresponsible. And I feel like the innovative aspect of those ideas fall apart if it doesn't come integrated with a reckoning with, you know, racial inequality, socioeconomic inequality, and who gets to actually, you know, opt out and still be a billionaire.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? Yeah. After you went to Stanford, mm-hmm, and you're like, I didn't need it. It's like, well,
yeah, it's like,
yes, I guess, you know,
check your privilege at the door, sir.
I mean, it's like, you know, if y'all cutting checks for everybody, let me know. You know, we all, none of us, like, y'all stop right now and we just go get that money. Yeah, I'm like, yeah, I too want to cultivate a life of exploration, you know, and mm-hmm, go to Mars. But again, it's like we're all on this Titanic, and I just don't think that we need to be entertaining solutions that are not, you know, mm-hmm, everybody gets a boat, you know.
Right.
Until everybody gets a boat, I'm not really trying to hear it. But yeah, absolutely. I think higher ed, you know, because it has these competing goals, runs into trouble trying to treat people as adults, right? Because part of what, and now we're speaking very broadly, but part of what institutions are actually also doing is holding space for adults that are adults becoming more adults. So there's there is a push and pull between the kind of policies and intentions that are pushing people to that growth edge and these caretaking attitudes and policies. And I think there's also a public perception of, at least for my experience, higher education institutions are incredibly, especially now, sensitive to the public's perception of them.
Mm.
And so it's like any kind of agitation by students is a disaster for, you know, any institution. And so I'm not sure that that's the best environment to be thinking through these problems. But, I mean, it's what we're dealing with, you know. I don't think that deans that are scared that, you know, the next protest will cost them their job necessarily are in the best position to be thinking about that, you know, what do we need and, you know, curriculum. I also think that they don't move towards curriculum, which I think that's what my work is about.
Mm.
We spend a lot of time thinking about everything but the classroom. And to me, I'm like, isn't college school? You know, I'm like, what?
Yeah, like what is the center of school, right? The classroom in this case.
Yeah.
I think that's an incredibly valid and important point to think about. We've certainly talked about this too as graduate students and other academic people we've talked with on the show, and just as thinking through what the role of being a student and a teacher is. And you're right. Like, even when you talk about how does one sort of become validated as an academic, and it's usually through publications and it's usually through these other things, and teaching is usually the last thing on the rung on the ladder.
Yeah.
That's like, don't get bad reviews from your students, and that's
right.
it.
You know?
And so I think that's precisely why like your work with Brave Community is so important, because it is saying, let's actually not flip the classroom, let's flip the academic calendar, right? The system, and say, actually, let's put classrooms much more present as a space, you know, as a laboratory, as a space of accountability.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think we think a lot. I think in this way, higher ed is very different than K-12. I think the K-12 research and practice literature has been really focused on pedagogy since like forever, and definitely after civil rights, right? We get culturally relevant pedagogy out of that. We get critical race theory and education out of that. These are people who are thinking about schools, K-12 schools. And that work is foundational to my work, but I think it's also foundational to how we've even like generally as a society thought about the purposes of education and thought of critically about, education is actually a kind of truncating experience for some students because they're different than dominant students. Higher ed has kind of not done that as much, but when it has, which is something that I also think I kind of push against, there's a lot of attention to not academic content. So there's a lot of attention to students' interpersonal lives, dorms, orientation programs, trainings, diversity this, diversity that, as opposed to what are you requiring that everybody that gets a degree from your institution know about? Tends to be a foreign language, quantitative skills, writing, and then depending on the institution, a range of things. Mm-hmm. Something in your major, blah, 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 right? Not engagement with race in America. Mm. I think that's an easy thing to say. Of course, people are like, that's ridiculous. It's politically impossible to think about. That you would be requiring brainwashing the youth. And in fact, it makes sense to me because you have an ideal situation. You have a subject matter that has been proven to increase the cognitive, you know, complexity of people, their ability to like think complex thoughts, hold two things, you know, imagine that, walk and chew gum intellectually at the same time. It does all these things. People are into it. They come, questions, they're ready. And then it has these like broadly democratic gains too, research shows. And if you're doing it in the context of what I study, which is academic courses, courses that they're not there to train anybody to be nice or have the right vocabulary. This is like content, you know, a history course, an anthro course, a sociology course. You could have a pick from your disciplines. You could select that your best professors teach these amazing seminars and you'd get it done. So for me, it's like, why not do that? You know, I would love for somebody to let me go and do an experiment with their, you know, 1,000 freshmen. Give me half. I put them in a seminar like that. Give me half and I put them in a writing course where that's the content. And then your other half, you give them your generic comp writing course that where you're like write a critical essay and you know whatever that is, and then let's follow those students, you know, and see. Why not? There's absolutely nothing about, you know, you could have whatever needs to be the litmus test for the politics, right? Like half the faculty are right wing, absolutely, and half the faculty are left wing, absolutely. That would, you know, they're not gonna, if they're serious academics, they're not gonna teach the sociology of race very differently. If they're serious, you know what I mean? You can get a little emphasis more, you know, somebody might give you more econ with their sociology, somebody might give you more history with their sociology, but they're, if they're serious, they know what they need to teach you.
Right.
Why not?
That's great. So if we have any deans or you know,
high people listening, holla at me.
We got some great ideas here.
Yes.
This is great. I don't know if you want to throw anything.
Not off the top of my head. I mean, just this, the why not question, I think, is a really great point to think about. And I think it resonates as well.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think the immediate why not would be like, that's propaganda or you can't tell anybody. what to study. And I think, sure, I think that would be an argument if you weren't actually telling people what to study all the time. So I think it's a matter of whether you think that that topic is really core to a functioning society. And I think if you pick up every institution's mission statement, it's like, absolutely. People have to get their diversity competencies. They need to be global citizens. They need to know. And it's like, well, are you serious about it? Or you just want to tell people where to live and who they can hang out with? Because I find that a harder... I think that in some ways, right, you would think theoretically that that would be like more palatable. Well, you know, but I find that more intrusive. I think that telling adults if they can or cannot have affinity groups or choose to live with people who with whom they share culture or ethnic background, I feel like I'm not saying institutions can't, but I find that a stranger incursion than to say you need this curriculum thing. Because they already do that. It's the business we're in. It's
is not, there anyway? Exactly.
Yeah, it's like, right. That's not weird. But telling somebody like, oh, you can't all hang out, you know, in the cafeteria together, all 12 of you.
Yeah.
That's weird, you know. Mm-hmm. Or you can't have this festival, or you can't, like, all the things that that institutions do that are like engineering interaction.
Mm-hmm.
They're hard to sell. This is not research-based, but anecdotally, students hate that stuff. They're like, what? Mm. Come on. But they take what you tell them to take. The credits, you know.
There's also that, too, right? I mean, you know, if they're going for, especially a named institution, right? They say this is a good place to be, a good degree. They're going to be usually pretty cool with it on some level, too.
Yeah.
Right, and I imagine that having these type of conversations would be something that would interest a lot of students.
Yeah.
And probably make them feel very comfortable, too.
Yeah, and my students, because now I have recent experience of having my own students, so I'm talking about doing it myself, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It is, as it was what I researched, with my own experience, it is edifying for people, you know. You can actually see folks stand up a little straighter when they are in the presence of something, I mean race, that used to have its grip on them, and now they've moved it to something that they've been able to interrogate and take some ownership about, you know. And I sat in a group of strangers and people who are different than myself, and I asked a very tricky question, and like my heart was racing, but it was fine, or it wasn't fine, and then it was fine, you know. And I read that text this way, but that other kid that looks completely different than me actually also read it the same way, but the kid that looks just like me was on a different page altogether. These are not experiences that Americans have in their upbringing, because we are completely segregated, schooling, extremely segregated, public discourse, mostly BS, if not complete obfuscation and like, you know? So folks, they don't even think it's possible. But they're really ready to do it. If there's somebody that says, look, I'm gonna take responsibility for this ride, we're gonna go on it, it's completely possible that we can do this.
Mm-hmm.
And I just don't know why it's not more common. That's kind of like, just do it. You know, people need, and I think that also goes back to the origin story, in the sense that it does keep me up at night, right? Like racism, if I'm the superhero, that is my nemesis. Racism is my nemesis. So there it is with its cape, but it thrives on our, you know, persistence in not interrogating it and testing it. Letting it alone is integral to its persistence.
Mm.
So why you would take 4 years out of young Americans' lives while they are completely immersed in the drama, the racial drama of their culture, they've been their whole lives, and offer nothing about that, I just think it doesn't make any sense. And then when people are having social interactions that are high stakes, voting, policing, decisions about where you live, now we want something that we didn't provide to kick in, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? After the election, everybody was like, empathy, where is it? I'm like, what? where are they getting that from?
I forgot to teach it, yeah.
Yeah, where would that come from? You want people who don't know each other, have been trained to think that one another is a complete freak of nature, don't know what kind of person you are, where you're coming from, to empathize now across this gap? Mm. And you want, you know, and you're mad that young people, you know, it's all this stuff. All the irritation with the snowflakes. And why can't they? It's like, where in your curriculum are people being given the right opportunity, right, to confront difficult knowledge, complicated ideas, problematic ideas, such that they don't, like, you know, throw a tantrum, burn down your campus? That's a fair question. You know, this abstract person, young person who just should know better than to be upset that a certain person is coming to campus, right? Mm. That's an abstract young person. That person doesn't exist. Mm. Where are the opportunities to, you know, be comfortable? Richard Spencer doesn't freak me out because I know a ton that keeps me from being freaked out by Richard Spencer. So that's the grounding argument, is that in the Brave community, the empathy comes from expertise. It comes from academic grounding. It builds as people learn.
Right.
It's not just like, I want to be cool, whatever you're saying, because I'm polite. It's not that. It's like, I'm going to be cool with whatever you're saying, because I understand, A, that we're in a learning relationship, and B, I have something actually grounded and concrete to say back to what you just said. Mm-hmm. So I don't need to feel threatened. I've been given tools to experience this exchange as your equal, right? In the public, we don't have that. You know, I think it's a lot to ask a young person of color in the wake of what we've seen with Black Lives Matter in this after this president to not freak out.
Yeah.
That there's, like, white supremacists everywhere, you know. These are, my son was a little kid when Obama was elected. I mean, I think we underestimate the degree to which this experience is traumatic for young people. And the adults, that's us, have provided very little orientation, comfort, except to judge them. Be like, what's wrong with you? Don't you know? Speeches, you know. Speech is the highest. You know what I'm saying? It's just like, are you serious right now? You have, you know, and the moment it's like, we keep telling them to stop overreacting, and the public environment keeps escalating.
And with that level of extremism, it's, you can't bridge that experience because you're seeing things that are just so polarized coming together. So whatever potential middle ground could be there is off to the side now.
Right, right. And I mean, I don't envy people who are on campuses that are like, that are blowing up, right? So, but you have to understand that you need to provide people, if we're in the business of developing human beings, you need to be about it. You know, there is, I think when you, especially when you're thinking about race, there is a rich body of knowledge that kind of sits, you know, it's kind of like so frustrating. It sits at the core of modern society, right? Like modernity comes out of slavery directly. So you have had people, fellow human beings, who have been, you know, step by step articulating that it is incorrect to dehumanize them in this way. And so for me, it's kind of a personal obligation that people are not educated while skipping that. It's like, we're, this is the story. We are part of this story. You cannot be an educated person and ignore that which is integral to all the other things you're learning. So I think that's kind of where, like, my drive comes to, is that you're teaching all this other stuff, right? You know?
Right.
You want people to know about democracy, right? You want to know about the Renaissance, right? Like, that's cool. We want, we're going to talk about the, how the superpower got to be a superpower. You want to teach all that. Okay, fine. then you need to bear witness to everything else that is built into the same thing. Mm-hmm. It'd be one thing if we don't, you know, you just teach people how to like make widgets. And you're like, we don't do that stuff, you know, but you don't. You want Americans to understand where they come from and all this stuff. And you keep leaving out a huge part of it. And then things blow up and folks are like, oh, why are they so sensitive?
Right, yeah.
The snowflakes, what are they doing? I'm like, they're fed up.
They're fed up, man. Snowflakes get fed up, you know?
Oh, my God. It's like a new century, you know what I mean?
Right. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And
we're on this again? Like, I feel like that, I mean, I don't want to speak for the youth, but I think, you know, that's the benefit of young people. Because young people, whether we like it or not, what they do is they show up, you know? It's like there's different times developmentally that learners come online at a frequency. College is an amazing frequency. They're like, okay, I left home. You know, like developmentally they're primed to switch worldviews, try stuff out. We're inciting them to do it. Yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm. Be, a free thinker and, you know, evidence and all that. And they look around and they're like, are y'all serious? Are you really kidding me right now? And the content that I studied brings people in confrontation with how long we've known better. You know what I mean? Like if you have a course on Black political thought, it's basically an epiphany followed by another epiphany by another epiphany that people have been having from the beginning. So the students are like, what? Really? How have I not been told? You know? Mm-hmm. Yeah. In my dissertation, I had a student who was so eloquent because he was like, you know, and this was a white student. He was like, he was in the Black political theory course. And he thought, he was thinking about the uprising in Baltimore, you know? And it's like a really, it's like one of those interview moments where the voice slows down because the person is really like, it's not, they can't believe. And he's like, you know, I've always been taught this version of events where the movement was very nice and, you know, polite and calm. And then there was this random rioting. And he's like, and right now, that's kind of how we've been taught to think about the uprising again. It's like, why are people rioting? Mm. And he's like, but based on the readings we've been doing, so they were reading stuff from before the Civil War, it's logical. He's like, it makes me uncomfortable because I'm white, but it's logical what's happening in Baltimore. And he just got it.
Wow.
It doesn't mean he's like pro uprisings or it wasn't that. It was just like something that I've been made to understand as really alien, incoherent, and very alienated from myself. Mm. I've been given an opportunity to integrate and be like, wait a minute. Mm-hmm. That actually makes sense to me. Like, I get it. I get what's going on.
Mm-hmm. That's where you see this kind of beauty, this antithesis of ignorance, right? Antithesis of fear by saying, right. Yes, if I can know it.
Right.
I love what you said. It's how long we've actually known better. Like, waking up to that fact is a huge piece.
Right.
Right. And that so many people say, what? Wait, they've been talking about this exact conversation
for
200 years? Yep.
Yeah.
And incredible to me. Yeah, it's think about and this other piece of like, are we serious about this, right? Are we serious to have this conversation?
I mean, how many times are people going to discover the fire next time? And be like, oh, what did he say? I'm like, yep, he did. When did he say it? Yep, he did say it. He did, you know, which is what we've just lived through. Uh-huh. It's like James Baldwin, a revival. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Always good. We should always have, we should never not have a James Baldwin revival. We should live in one. But again, it's like I tell my students all the time that when they read texts like that and it blows their mind, I also ask them to think about what would that person think? Mm. You know, what would he sound like today? Mm-hmm. You know, if you write that when he wrote it, and what would he sound like today? They're like, oh, not nice is what he would sound like. You know, very irritated, probably not polite anymore. So, it's part of it.
I think and a beautiful thought, I mean, we might close thinking about this, is like that bravery is not about being polite, right? It's about like being accountable to action and to conversation and to being intellectually, you know, available.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that's I think why this notion of brave community is so key. And I think everything you said has been so wonderfully to sit and hear and to be a part of this.
Thank it's you.
Because like, classrooms are the place where this is like
the only place.
Yeah.
The only place. Right. I think the important idea to stress in the concept is like the relationship between that bravery and that empathy, right? Mm. So the intellectual courage is the bravery piece. The interpersonal empathy is the community piece. And what that means is that my brave learning is received empathetically by my peers as a student in that space. Mm. Otherwise, it's microaggressions, it's all of the things that people are used to and reflect on and write about and resent. So the only really way that this works is in community. Mm. So I get a lot of questions that are like catastrophe questions. What happens if somebody says X, Y, and Z racist thing? Mm-hmm. And the answer is always like, what happened before that moment? Because there's two answers. If you are in community and you're asking me what happens when a bad moment happens, I've seen faculty, I've observed faculty who save the moment, right? So it's usually you model the bravery, you kind of come into the space that's been breached and the discomfort and you name it. You say, hey, y'all, sounds like, you know, so-and-so is really upset. Maybe we need to take a break. But that there needs to be a community there to react. If you haven't done any of that work, what happens? It's like, well, bad things, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, it's this idea that the two things are connected. I think that they're integral to learning about race. And I think that they are, that what I've observed is a processual thing. It's it's a cultural thing. It's the thing that, you know, students were only able to kind of help me figure this out after. You know, like in the research, it was like the interviews after the class. Because during, they wouldn't have been able to call it like what it was. It was after. Why did you think that class was distinct? Mm. And it's like, oh, it was something in the air, you know, like this is how you experience a cultural experience. You're not really, oh, I see what's going on right now. We're in Brave Community 1.0, and you know, that's not real. It's like afterwards. Well, what did you think you were doing? And sometimes the faculty I interviewed also were actually much more focused on what they thought their content requires. Mm-hmm. So it's not automatic. These are gifted pedagogues, but it's also not rocket science. Hmm. They're like, you know, I'm just not going to be able to, it's America, these are undergraduates, and I'm not going to be able to teach this content if I don't set some stuff up, you know? Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's not that deep. It's not like, oh, no one took a course and, you know, gained another expertise. You know, it's just like, I'm going to teach about race. I want it to be rigorous. I want it to be challenging. I need them to be part of this with me. So what am I going to say to, you know, invite that in?
I think fostering the community is part of the challenge.
Right.
But like you're saying, this can be done in any classroom, fostering a community from the start. And I think that's something we all need to keep in mind moving forward, especially with this series, that it's any conversation we have is going to start with at least that step of recognizing the communities around you when you're in a higher ed situation. And that's on part of the instructor, which could be all of us in this room.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we can help make that happen.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. This has been an enlightening and great conversation. Thank you so much for sharing your time with us.
Thank you. Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
If the good people want to reach out, is there any best way to find you?
My email.
Yeah.
It's jad600@mail.harvard.edu, I think. No, that is correct. And I'm on Twitter at JDENOVAIS. But I am on Social Media Detox, so they should know that.
Mm-hmm. You can reach out, but there'll be no response.
Yeah, they will eventually. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much. It's been great.
And we want to thank Brandeis University for giving us the opportunity to have this series. We're going to continue on throughout the rest of the semester, so tune in for more episodes. And as always,
This AnthroLife is partnered with the American Anthropological Association, the Society for Applied Anthropology, Sapiens, and EPIC.
That's right. So as our family grows, we hope you grow with us, and our community keeps growing too. And so we love this work, and we hope you've enjoyed this conversation. We'll be coming out with some more episodes in the Diversity and Inclusion series throughout the semester, as Ryan said. We hope you keep enjoying and keep engaging the conversation with us. These are important conversations that we believe need to be had, and we're seeing across Twitter, across Facebook, across just social media and writing in general. This is definitely where a lot of the conversations are at. So thanks for sticking with us and hanging out. And, you know, as always, tweet at us. Let us know your favorite takeaways, favorite ideas. If you like the show, please, you know, fire us 5 stars on iTunes. It's one of the best compliments you can give us because it helps other people find the show. Or just feel free to send them our you know, web address or whatever, if you listen on Android or whatever. We try to be in as many places as possible for you, our listeners, and want to help grow the community of holistic thinkers, social consciousness, and generating empathy, because we need these conversations right now more than ever. So, with that being said, hope to see you next time on This Anthro Life. As always, this is Adam Gamwell.
And I'm Ryan Collins.
See you next time.